Hey, PJ, Jeffrey Wells speaking.
Hey, Jeffrey, how you doing?
Pretty good, man. How are the sound levels? Can you hear me and everything?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay. So you guys do a lot of entertaining up in New Hampshire.
We do. We do, especially during the two months of nice weather that we get every year.
And you guys have a beautiful kind of a sort of a colonial-style pillbox home?
Yeah, we do. We do. It's a fantastic house. It was built in the 1790s, and some lady back in the 30s, some lady found it. It was a derelict house about 50 miles from here, and she found it, and she had it taken apart and moved over here to a kind of hilltop and put back together again.
Interesting. You know, it's funny that one of my very first memories when I was maybe 4 or 5 years old was of a house literally being moved en masse, the entire thing.
Oh, I saw that when I was a kid too. We had some, they were building highways in back in Toledo, Ohio, and
yeah.
And somebody chose to keep their house, and I saw it rumbling down the road at about like one half of 1 mile an hour, all jacked up on.
Isn't that funny? You have the same.
Yeah, of course, it like really impresses you as a kid. Whoa!
Yeah.
Like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. Yeah.
Another early memory, as long as I'm speaking, one of the earliest memories I have of is when I first saw Death. I had a kind of girlfriend. Her name is Sue Ellen, and she lived about 4 or 5 homes away, and she was howling and screaming in misery because her dog had been run over by a truck, a delivery truck. He was a little black spaniel, and the poor dog, the only thing that was left was literally a rug, if you will.
Exactly. It was okay when that happened to a cat, because then you got a sale cat. You could buy it up and use it as a frisbee. But dogs, that was out of bounds.
So I got really enthusiastic about wanting to speak to you because I fell heavily in love with Drunk Stone Brilliant Dead in January at the Sundance Festival. Were you up there when that showed, by
any chance? No, not long. In fact, I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. Have you read the book that it was?
Oh, sure. Yeah. In fact, Rick sent me an advanced copy, and I did read that. The only thing about the book, and I gave Meyerowitz some crap about this. Mm-hmm. He's an art director, you know?
Yeah.
So he goes to reprint various stories from the National Lampoon, famous old stories, you know, that any Lampoon fan.
Yeah.
And all the artwork is there in all its splendor and its glory. But I don't know, about 1 out of 10 times, like when the copy jumps,
mm-hmm.
no copy.
No jump?
Because he's an art director and they can't read.
Oh, my God. Okay. Oh, wow.
Can't read, don't read. He didn't want a bunch of gray pages in his book. You know? So you'll be reading Battling Buses of WW2, which has got these fabulous illustrations, but it also has body copy that we worked hard on.
Mm.
You know, and like the body copy goes along for about a paragraph and then disappears forever.
Well, you guys were doing right to the end days. You were in the last phase. You were the editor during the last phase.
Well, I wasn't really. The magazine puttered on. I left at the beginning of '81, and the magazine had a fair amount of after history to it.
You're right. You're right. Yeah, I misspoke.
Yeah.
But I remember your. I guess I'll put it this way. Your period, I remember, is the last. Hurrah period, the period that I was really into.
There was kind of 10 years of the Lampoon from 70 through 80,
right.
11 years, I guess, technically, was at the beginning, like the first couple of issues, most of the first year, magazine was crap.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that until I went to work there, because I didn't see the magazine until 71.
Yeah.
And I kind of remember that it existed, but I hadn't really looked at it. And it was sometime within the first year, basically, the main thing that happened was Michael Gross came in as the art director.
Yeah.
They had some, like, hippies that I kind of knew from hanging around in hippie world in New York as the art directors and with predictable results. Michael Gross, grown-up art director comes in, and they also had the sense to, they were floundering around a little bit for copy at the beginning. I mean, it was like, I think right at the beginning, it was like poor Henry Beard and Doug Kenny were, you know, reusing pseudonyms because they were basically writing all the copy in the magazine.
Yeah, pretty much everything, right?
I mean, they did. But they got, thank God, they got in touch with Michael O'Donoghue. And O'Donoghue, sometime again during that first year before I was there, he began to exert his influence. Right. And like the first issue I really remember, and I think it may have been in, still in 1970, was one about hippies, where they had a hippie in a like a sideshow target, you know, where he could throw beanbags at it.
That's great.
And from there on, you know, it was just brilliant. It had about brilliant run of about 4 years there, through maybe sort of 74, 75. And then it went through a period where it was edited by committee. Doug and Henry left in 75, and there was a period, 75, 76, 77, when the magazine was run by committee with the results, you know, as dire as the hippies, you know, but in a different way. There were some good things in the magazine during that period, but it was inconsistent, to say the least.
Yeah. That was in those days, the interesting part about editing magazines. I first had my first managing editor job in 81.
Oh, yeah, so you know of what you speak here, yeah.
That was the tedious having to print out and the...
Oh, editing. My God, everything had to be read three times.
Yeah, I know. But you
and three different formats, you know.
Yeah.
First in a smudgy manuscript, you know, then in like a set copy that had been all marked up with mysterious runes by the by the people in the copy editing department of, you know, that you'd never seen the trolls in the copy editing department down in the third subcellar.
Yeah.
And then there'd be blues. Excuse me, everything had to be read four times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then you'd read the blues. And then there'd be like, you know, the magazine itself, which of course you had to read on Monday morning after it was published, to sit everybody down and say, what the fuck happened here?
But I'll tell you one thing I clearly associate with the National Lampoon in its glory period is that it was a very well honed magazine. I was delighted with the sentences that I read in that thing.
Anyway, back to the three periods of first 10 years of Lampoon before I lose my thread here, is that then at the end of 77, I took over, and it wasn't that I was good, it was just that I wasn't a committee, you know, so at least there's like one person making stupid decisions instead of like half a dozen people making stupid decisions.
Yeah.
So the stupidity went down by a factor of, you know, whatever, that is, mathematically. And the other thing is that John Hughes came on board full time, you know, and he was just fucking great, you know, and incredibly productive, you know, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So we got like a second burst. But back to what you were saying about the sentences is that, boy, it took me when I started to freelance for Lampoon in end of 71 or something like that. You know, it took me about 2 years to get up to speed with those Harvard boys. I mean, they could fucking write a sentence, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember talking to George Trow one time about this. He'd gone to Exeter.
Right.
And it wasn't Harvard, really. Like, they seemed to have been just, like, fucking off at Harvard like everybody was fucking off at college.
Yeah.
Except they didn't have any girls to fuck off with. So, was their prep school educations.
Mm-hmm.
George said that every Monday morning when he went to Exeter, they were given a topic, and they had to turn in 1,000 words on that topic on Friday morning.
Mm.
And you don't go through that for 4 years without... and these, you know, these weren't just, you know, given a little pasted on gold star and a note of encouragement about self-expression. You know, there's some fussy old maniac who'd been, you know, thrown out of his real job for child molesting or something.
I was very taken.
They're marking up the paper.
There was a great interview that I that you did in Vegas with a guy from Reason TV.
Oh God, I didn't and he must have, you're the person who saw that.
That's a very enlightening and intelligent and very well phrased interview on both your parts. It really.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah. And I was just thinking, though, he was talking about the basic irreverence that baby boomers had about the conditions, about the mentality, about the mindset that they got from their parents. The greatest generation parents, as we all know, were largely defined by the hardships of the Depression and World War
II. Yeah, which I would never let you forget about.
And I basically felt that there was something that was very suffocating and almost horrendous in a psychological way about the way my parents told me that there were basically predators who were lurking everywhere.
Oh my God! You know, I think I talked about this in my book, The Baby Boom. I mean, I would hear not my own parents so much, but I'd hear other people's parents like going things like, "That Riley boy, he knows perfectly well the Williamsons are on vacation. I'll bet he just took that newspaper he's supposed to be delivering, you know, and kept the 3 cents."
Yeah.
A, I know the Riley kid. He's not that smart. And B, it's 3 cents. And God, my father-in-law is still like that. He's like until he's born 25, you know. So he's like perfect, greatest generation, forward artillery observer in World War II, career FBI agent. Worked not Omaha carjacking, but or truck jacking, but New York organized crime.
Yeah.
And then he was head of corporate security for General Electric. And, I mean, this is a man with a wealth of experience in life. And he goes to get an open heart operation. He goes, they're just ripping him up. They're just ripping me off. Yeah. I don't need this operation. You know, they're just, it's just the way they're paying. You know those heart surgeons.
Right.
I'm just paying for their vacation house. You're on the tit for Medicaid.
There's a but what I think made the Lampoon, so people were ready, very ready, and for National Lampoon's styled humor, but what made it work for me, that little special turn in the lock, was that it was snooty. It had a very learned, snooty.
Oh yeah, that's what those Harvard kids brought to it. You know, was this like sense of like unearned superiority. And you know what they also didn't bring to it was an agenda. Everybody forgets how serious the '60s was. You know, I mean all that. Peace and love, dude. Crap. People were really intensely sort of literal, earnest.
Yeah.
Earnest is the key word about the '60s. And well, here comes Lampoon. That's not earnest at all. I mean, it's got the same set of hatreds. You know, we hate everything about the America we grew up in because it was boring.
Right.
But it carried with it none of that hippy-dippy earnestness.
Yeah.
Which was, I mean, it was sickening even at the time. Looking back on it, it's like...
Are you when I think of, you're pretty much the standard bearer in the realm that I pay attention to, which is writing and Hollywood and television, of libertarianism along with Bill Maher. Do you consider Bill Maher to be the same kind of libertarian that you are?
No, I think Bill and I are sort of the alpha and omega of libertarianism, actually. He's a left libertarian, I'm a right libertarian, you know. I'm very conservative, small c, conservative about things, and more so now that I've got, like, one of the things that's very different about Bill and me is that I've got 3 kids, two of whom are teenagers.
Right.
I'll make a conservative out of anybody. I'm very Burkean sort of conservative. Boy, you know, don't try anything new Hilaire Belloc has got a wonderful, in one of his nursery poems, in his, like, Bad Poems for Worst Children or whatever it was like, not about a little boy who was eaten by a lion, and it ends up, never let a hold of nurse for fear of finding something worse. And that's my attitude, you know, so, like, you know, corporate bankers are horrible people, no doubt, you know, but who's going to take over, you know, rather have them running the bank than Hillary, you know, so...
It's a funny thing, because you're saying something that I feel emotionally, but if it comes down to my voting, let's say, for Hillary and...
Yeah, versus, like, Jeb Bush.
I think most people feel there's something awful about a third Bush in the White House. And
there is, you know, and no offense to Jeb, who seems to be, like, probably the best of the bunch.
He's the most reasonable.
He's a competent enough governor of Florida, which can't be an easy state to run.
And yet he's not really exciting what you would call any kind of real groundswell of passion out there.
No! I mean, everybody's gone, okay, I guess, you know, I mean, I don't know.
Who is exciting groundswells of passion?
Nobody, I don't think. Bernie Sanders among his ilk.
And Donald Trump?
Nobody. I mean, you know, all the Democrats I've talked to feel the same way about Hillary that I feel about Jeb, you know?
Yeah.
Even though they may like her a lot more than, you know, I like her. Even though I may like Jeb a lot better than they like him, it comes down to the same, oh, God, here we go again.
I would be okay. I think she, from my perspective, she would be more or less another right-center Obama-type administrator, more or less.
Probably more to the right-center than Obama.
You mean from an international standpoint, she's more hair trigger, right?
Yeah, I think she's probably a little tougher on foreign policy. After all, she tried the Obama recipe for world peace.
Yeah.
That didn't work out. The Clintons was, I mean, Bill, her husband, deployed U.S. troops, I think, more times than any other U.S. president ever has.
Mm-hmm.
Although not, we have to. Yeah. That's judging it quantitatively rather than qualitatively. He didn't give us the Iraq War.
Right. But
he had U.S. troops scurrying around all over the place.
But as a kind of a right libertarian, you must be profoundly uncomfortable with the current crop, particularly Donald Trump. Don't you feel?
Oh, Donald Trump's an abomination. I mean, I wrote a piece for somebody. I think it was the Weekly Standard where I said. I wrote a piece about the debate and about watching the debate, and I said, you know, how much better a World Wrestling Federation would have been, you know, because then the other nine candidates could have dragged Donald Trump around the ring by his hair. And this was before he cut loose with the with his comments on Megyn Kelly, who upon whom I have an enormous crush. You
know? That was really strange. I don't think I have a feeling that he's not really thinking through or preparing himself.
You think?
But how could he presume that he's going to prevail, and even into the midpoint of the primary season, unless he does the standard buckle down, do your homework, figure your stuff out?
He is not, as the French would say, l'homme sérieux. And even country club Republican types that I knew that were going around saying, at least Donald Trump says what he thinks, he's not the only person to feel that way, he's the only person to say it, you know, and even they, after that debate and the Megyn Kelly stuff, are going, oh, Jesus, you know, spare us, get him out of there.
You know, it's funny what you were saying about Hillary, though, because as much as I more or less am comfortable with some of what she stands for, will probably implement, I don't have any real liking for her. She irritates me. Whenever I say that, I find her bothersome and not terribly pleasing to the eye, to the ear. I'm called a sexist. I'm called a...
An ageist sexist. Well, about Hillary, I don't care. You know, I wouldn't care if she looked like Lana Turner. Yeah. The thing is, once you've seen the movie Election...
Yep. That was a beautiful film. I love that film.
Isn't that a wonderful one? You know, have you read the book?
No.
The book is rather different than the movie and equally good. The book's a little darker.
Doesn't Tracy Flick prevail at the end with power?
Yeah. The plot line's the same.
Yeah, okay.
Obviously, the novel has more detail about people's lives because it has room to. It's a rare example of a brilliant book turned into a brilliant movie, and yet the two of them aren't the same thing. You know, mm-hmm. It's not like the Man Who Would Be King, which is one of my favorite movies,
mm-hmm.
is almost word for word the Kipling book.
Okay.
Hmm. And that's because the book was a novella and therefore was like before the fact, accidentally screenplay length.
Okay. Is the Matthew Broderick character more depraved in some way? How is it darker? What's the?
I think if people are unhappier.
Okay.
I think would be the overall take. Tom Perrotta. I don't know if you've read any of his stuff. He is awfully good. College Joe is one of his novels. He's got a collection of short stories called Bad Haircut. He did this novel about suddenly like a third of the population disappears. It's sort of
that's the link.
Version of The Rapture.
Yes, exactly. That's called the it's the HBO thing, and the new series begins the second series, I should say, season begins in a couple weeks.
Yeah, I heard about that. It pisses me off because I have a feeling that's why there's not a new Tom Perrotta novel.
Yeah,
over there busy getting paid decent amount of money.
It's a strange concept though when you think about it, because all throughout the entire history of the human species, there's been this sense of is it more or less mathematical chaos? Is it just random chance? Is there some kind of scheme or design? And of course, there's no absolute answer. And what this cataclysm, this sudden disappearance of 2% actually of
the that's right, yeah.
That means that of course there is a design. There's a whole order. And
yeah, but what is it?
But nobody says anything.
They're just random.
Yeah.
The leftovers. There we go. I just Googled.
Yeah. Anyway.
He is so good. Anyway, and he really captures suburban unhappiness.
Yeah. That is really, it's funny how some movies, you don't really know it immediately at the time, but it's amazing how the way some films gain and become stronger the older they get. And Election is definitely one of those. You know.
Animal House,
yeah. Boy, I mean, that piece that you wrote about the Hollywood, for the Hollywood Reporter, in which you, How I Destroyed the National Lampoon, that was so spot on. You, I take it you had not seen the new vacation film when you wrote it. You were
Oh, no, I saw all that was available, which was the trailer, which is like, whoa, really cringy. You really hope that you're not in the, you know, in the theater watching Frozen 5, you know, when...
Well, that was one of the worst times I've ever seen in front of a screen in my life. That was a horribly awful, crude base film that had nothing at all. And I'm not really that much of a fan of the Chevy Chase. Was it 83 when that came out?
Yeah, no, it wasn't like, you know, you can see John Hughes. I mean, first place, he doesn't have the leverage for any kind of creative control.
Yeah.
Second place is you can see him sort of fumbling toward the apotheosis of the perfect suburban movie, you know.
Yeah. Whereas that original short story that he did with the angry, grumbling dad and the station wagon and driving, that was actually pretty good. That was one.
Oh, that was brilliant. Yeah, the short story was brilliant. But John was just learning to turn that stuff into movies,
right.
And he's also just learning how to deal with the people that he had to deal with in order to turn the stuff into movies.
And they mushed it up, is what you're telling me.
What's that?
They mushed it up, took the edge.
Oh, yeah, they mushed it up, you know, and John wasn't in a position to say, no, you know, I mean, he was in, you know, very much in that stage of his career where, you know, the Polish actress comes to Hollywood and fucks the writers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, so you're half the time in D.C. and half the time in New Hampshire.
No, not anymore. We're full time in New Hampshire now.
Okay. All right. So
we gave up our place. We kept our place in D.C. for a long time, and we realized that with three kids in school up here, we were using it, you know, like.
Yeah.
And then my wife's parents moved in next door to us, and so we weren't even going, like, you know, to see them down in Connecticut at Christmas anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, and therefore, you know, we used to go down and see them at Christmas, then we'd go down and spend New Year's in Washington. You know, we weren't on the circuit anymore.
Do they live in Connecticut? I come from Wilton. What part of
right next door, at Westport.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's my old stomping grounds back in the
Yeah. In fact, Tina and I were 20 years ago this fall. We're married down there in that
Westport.
Well, the immediate suburbs around there's Weston. There's, I think it was in Weston. Mm-hmm. There's like a restaurant on the river there. Does a lot of weddings.
Cobb's Mill Inn.
Cobb's Mill Inn. Yeah, that's exactly where we got married.
I just had a memorial luncheon for my mother who just passed.
Oh.
And it was really, it's a beautiful place, though, you know.
It was a really nice place. And then we had we had like the rehearsal dinner at the country club down there.
Yeah.
Can't remember. Yeah, that's a great, you know. Sometimes we look, you know, especially when we were going back to visit Tina's parents, we would look around enviously at a livelier place.
Yeah. So how
New Hampshire.
How digitally connected are you in your home? I mean, how good is your Wi-Fi and all that?
Digitally connected? Yeah. Terribly. Okay. Terribly. We barely get, we're on a landline right now, and there's a good reason for it, because we barely get cell connection up here. We had to, like, run a wire as thick as your wrist from here to somewhere in Connecticut in order to get high-speed computer connection.
Okay, all right. And I was just going to say, there's a thing that you can buy from AT&T these days that boosts your signal within your home for... it really makes things a lot better when you...
Oh, that's probably a good idea for us, yeah.
But I was
just... because we have I watch my wife and two out of three of my children trundling around the house trying to find a place where their laptop connects to the Wi-Fi.
Do you really still type on the Selectric? Is that still your motor?
No, I gave that thing up. It, you know, it's first place, it's unrepaired. The guy who repaired it died. And I mean the guy who repaired it died. It's like one guy left. And besides, once I got a decent screen and keyboard, and I got used to writing on the writing on Word, an annoying program, but nonetheless, everything's much less work than it was with the.
One of the most brilliant things you ever did for me in all your writings, and I've read maybe a quarter of your books, but there's a brilliant piece you read in which you were talking or leaning in the direction of feeling a certain level of boredom or not feeling engaged with the topic, and then the next paragraph was just a mass of keys that had made an impression.
Oh, right, where I fell my life when I went to sleep. It was about Jimmy Carter.
Okay, that was.
In fact, it was a review of one of Jimmy's books.
That was one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen. I've got to take my hat off. I've always.
Thank you.
And also remember
Banker.
This is like the early 90s, as I recall.
Something like that, yeah.
And I remember also a line that has stuck with me. There's a line that you wrote about how life would be unbearable without alcohol.
Yes.
I used to say to myself, that's the way I feel. That's the way I feel. But then I became sober in 2012, and then everything kind of changed. But it's a, did you ever do a sobriety thing, or have you always enjoyed your...
No, every now and then I'll go on the wagon. I had some kidney problems, this is years ago now, but about 30 years ago I had some kidney problems, and I had to quit drinking for 6 months.
Okay.
And boy, are my friends loud and repetitive.
That's exactly right. It's funny. You forget how to laugh at parties initially.
I know. Yeah, and it took. So I was glad when I got cured of the kidney problem. Then my friends became subtle and amusing again, witty and charming.
yeah. So speaking as just pride in certain pieces that you've written, what National Lampoon piece do you today feel the proudest of, because it was the best shaped and had the best delivery and everything?
Oh, gee, I don't know. You know,
you don't have any
hard. Because there were things that were that turned out very well, that turned out to have an enduring appeal that I just sort of tossed off, like how to drive fast on drugs. Can your wing wing squeeze and not spill your drink? And then there are other things that were like, you know, really like I mentioned it before, battling buses of WW2, where like my friend Alan Rose, unfortunately, just died. It was drew the pictures for that. Mm-hmm. We just, you know, that was like real labor of love. I guess the high school yearbook. If I had to pick out a single thing that Doug Kenny and I did most of, there were other contributors, but
what most, was that piece that you did post Lampoon in which you and a woman decided to investigate and get into Christianity and fundamentalist Christianity. And I forget this wonderful line. He says, we immersed ourselves in this world. And,
oh, yeah, Jim Baker.
And we came away converted. Unfortunately, we were converted to Satanism.
Exactly. Yeah, that was my friend. She's actually out in Los Angeles now.
Okay.
Allie Brantley.
Okay.
She's like a TV and movie producer.
Mm-hmm.
I think mostly mother of several children nowadays. But anyway, Allie Brantley and I went. I use some other name for her, but mm-hmm. she and I went to Jim and Tammy Baker's. And what happened? We did. It was a piece for Playboy.
Okay.
And just as we came home from that, the whole Jim and Tammy empire fell to pieces.
Mm. Okay.
So it ended up, you know, being a completely different piece than it set out to be.
Yeah.
But the thing is that I'll never forget is Allie is like rather straight-laced.
Mm-hmm.
Not straight-laced exactly, but I mean she's a proper Southern girl from Asheville, North Carolina.
Yeah.
And grew up in a plight and prosperous family down there.
Mm-hmm.
And Allie, for some reason, like Jim and Tammy's, whatever it was called,
mm-hmm.
Jim and Tammy Land,
yeah.
made Allie just wildly horny. To the point where she's going, come on, I bet we can get behind the Coke machine and do it. there was no place to do it. I thought it was very endearing. And, you know, I extend my thanks to this very day to Jim and Tammy, wherever they may be.
Yeah. Having suffered on a daily basis almost from the politically correct Stalinists out there who beat me up, have beaten me up a lot for a lot of things, I have to take my hat off for a piece that would probably get you roasted if you were to write it today. It's called Foreigners Around the World.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Well, to this day, it's never been in a collection of mine. It is Samizdat.
But I'll tell you, you laid it out there. It was brave and funny. You're obviously standing back and satirizing people who were simplistic and stupid and not very perceptive and insensitive to people. But it was funny because you captured that way of looking at people of other...
It was like a real exercise in the attempt to channel almost as a sort of stand-up performance the xenophobia, with a capital Xeno, to it. And yet at the same time, it was also product of a moment in the 70s, which mm-hmm. turned out to be a false moment in the 70s, and there were many of them, actually, if I think about it. This sort of false moment... in the 70s, when we thought we're finally over that. I don't mean over the racism. We felt we were over, like, the racism and the xenophobia, but we were also over the fucking piousness about not having it.
Yeah.
Well, that didn't turn out to be true.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a hilarious piece. I just want.
Thank you.
You know, and it's one of the ballsiest.
I'll leave that to be collected after I'm dead, I think.
Yeah, I also loved. I have a copy of Republican Party Reptile, which is that image of Dwight D. Eisenhower and
the Mohawk haircut. Yeah, we finally had to change the cover, and I when we came out with that thing has remained in print all these years. And so
why did you have to change the cover?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Why did you have to change the cover?
That's what I said. I said, I love that cover. And Morgan Entrecon, the guy who runs Gross, says, nobody knows what Eisenhower looks like anymore.
Okay.
It's just like a mysterious old guy in a mohawk, as far as anybody under the age of 40 is concerned.
Yeah. All right. Well, I hope that given that you're, I hope you can see the film. You ought to really try and show.
I actually have a copy on my desk, but it's been August, you know, and so I've been.
What's your routine as far as writing? When do you like to write the best?
Oh, it's just a job. I get up when the kids get up to go to school, and when they go to school, I go to my office lunch.
How many hours are you good? Can you write for really long periods, or you just like?
I can. I'm probably good for. I'm good for eight, you know, with time off for lunch.
Yeah.
More if I have to, but really, I'm good for about somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 a day, depending on what kind of writing it is, you know.
That's a good
I consider 1,000. I feel if I'm really working on something, Of course, nowadays pieces tend to be shorter, so it's more like I'll be finishing up, you know, trying to do a piece in a day. But if I'm working on something longer, if I haven't gotten 1,000 words of it at the end of the work day, I feel a little, you know.
Yeah, I know the
feeling.
Like
I've left something on the plate or something, or, you know, I've fucked off.
Things have to be shorter, you mean because of ADD, short attention spans, people don't like to read any more than 400 or 500 words? Is that what you mean?
Well, that's part of it. You know, I mean, there certainly is that aspect to it, but it's also media, you know, the medium is the message, as Marshall McLuhan used to say.
Yeah.
And I myself find longer things hard to read on the computer screen. They just, you know, even though that I can adjust the type size and the brightness, it's probably easier on my old eyes.
Right.
Nonetheless, I find it hard to read. I am reading right now an extremely difficult book, which is incidentally just fucking brilliant, called Skag Boys.
Okay.
By the train spotter guy.
Okay. And it's about heroin users and...
Yeah, this is basically a prequel to Trainspotters. This is how they got that way.
Okay.
And this is like young people, teens and early 20s, back in the Margaret Thatcher 80s when, you know, everything is just going to fucking pieces for working class people in Britain. It's funny because... Irving Welsh's politics and mine couldn't. I met him in London about 6 months ago or 4 months ago, and he's the best. He's just a great guy. And, like, I'm reading this and I'm going, like, you know, hey, give a fuck about the miners' union.
Yeah.
But he makes me care.
Yeah.
And
he's a hardcore lefty, you're saying, and politically speaking.
What's that?
He's a hardcore lefty, politically speaking.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, at least in the persona, I don't know him well enough to know that, but I would, yes, he and I were talking about the Scottish elections and the Scottish Independence Party and stuff, and my guess would be yes, that he is.
Well, one thing that I hope...
But very polite about it.
One thing that I hope that comes out of people seeing Drunk, Stone, Brilliant, Dead, which is, I hope it really catches on, but I have a feeling that most people under 30... My son is 27. I have a youngest son who's 25. They aren't really attuned to the old issues of National Lampoon. They understand that Saturday Night Live and that whole explosion of the mid 70s came from the magazine, but they haven't really savored it. And it's so delicious. It's so amazing. I hope that.
Yeah, it's a shame. You know, it's sort of like I suppose the comparable thing for us would have been like the New Yorker back in Algonquin Roundtable days.
The Benchley pieces, which I used to love when I was...
Oh, me too. Me too. And I'm glad to say I actually read them. But I remember there was a stage where I sort of knew about that.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what it was.
And his little short films, which I thought were really...
Oh, they were hilarious. Still are hilarious.
Yeah.
And, but fortunately, not too long after that, I started to read Dorothy Parker, and I started to read S.J. Perlman, and I started to read...
Yeah.
It's like high school. But I can remember a point there where, you know, I kind of knew about the Round Table and the abstract, but, you know, and I knew they were supposed to be clever, but I didn't know quite, you know, what kind of clever they'd been or what they were being clever about. So I suppose that's probably about the same generational time lag, you know.
So you're indicating that millennials today, your kids, you have three kids, are probably just not interested and probably never will be interested until they...
Oh, well, I mean, you know, there also is an element of you had to be there, you know?
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, there's, you know, some stuff from the Lampoon endures, and Meyerowitz was pretty good at picking it out.
Right.
But, not all of it, though. Some of it was very topical, you know. I mean, it was like occasional poetry, you know. I mean, if you weren't around for the occasion, it probably doesn't work for you very well.
I got from the film, by the way, that it was Henry who mainly wrote the letters column in the old days.
Yes, I believe so. By the time I got there full time, everybody, you know, lots of people were contributing to the letters column.
Mm.
But Henry, for years, wrote it pretty much on his own, yeah.
And that is really, really brilliant. And I wish that the people who have the archives would just simply make it available for a reasonable fee online, because to my knowledge, you still can't do that.
I don't think you can, and that's just, you know, that the whole corporate tangle of the National Lampoon, it was kind of fucked to begin with, and boy, over the years, it has gotten really ripely fucked. I don't even know who owns it now, some Saudi prince or like some bag lady. I couldn't tell you, you know.
But that's really a shame, because particularly with the film generating presumably a certain level of interest.
Yeah. The Hollywood Reporter did a sidebar about Lampoon's corporate situation, but I have to say I emerged from reading the sidebar no wiser than I went in. You know, yeah. I mean, not because there was anything wrong with the writing, but just the corporate situation is so damn tangled.
Yeah, that kind of tangling kind of puts me to sleep when I read about it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, thanks, man. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate you sharing, and I love your stuff, and I hope you just keep cranking it up for the next five.
Yeah, well, stay in touch. It was fun to talk to you.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.